Welcome to Manager Tools. Today's cast, How to Choose a Managerial Successor, Part 1. The questions this cast answers are, how do I choose a successor? What qualities should I look for in a successor? And can I choose a successor for a subordinate manager? If you'd like answers to these questions and more, keep listening. The other day, we were gathering data on the clients we've served over the past 5 years. Imagine that. We have data. Even we were surprised at the breadth of workplace disciplines and industries that we've served. It runs the gamut from technology to software, finance, healthcare, government, retail, educational, manufacturing, nonprofit, restaurant management, religious affiliations. You name it, we've probably worked with an organization in your space. Because after all, effective management is just that. Effective management, no matter what the industry. If you're interested in bringing us on site to work with your team today, send us an email to customerservice@manager-tools.com. So, Kate.
Succession.
I know, succession. I'd like to add another thing formally to the list of things that managers are responsible for, but they don't know that they're responsible for. If I might. There must be a master list somewhere.
For sure, you're the right person to do it. It's us. That's our job.
Yeah.
And it's true, a lot of managers don't know that they're supposed to do it. Further, often they don't do it because they don't name a successor or number two, because I'm jumping ahead. Most managers don't name a successor or number two, even though they're obligated to do so, partially because they don't know. And it's even worse, it's more endemic than that. Most executives don't realize they're supposed to hold managers accountable to do so.
Exactly.
So you don't know you're supposed to do it. Your boss doesn't ask you to do it. And even if your boss doesn't demand it, it is still part of being an effective manager.
Mm-hmm. And I would say that the real conundrum of this whole thing is you don't know you're supposed to do it. Your manager's not, or your executive manager, I should say, isn't holding you accountable for doing it, but they're still expecting you do it. And that's the hard part, right? They didn't tell you to do it, and they're not holding you accountable for doing it, but they assume you've done it in some way, shape, or form, and you very likely haven't. And for the record, today's cast is an extension of a previous topic we covered. We touched on the topic in 2009. The guidance at the time was quick and dirty choosing a number two. So this is going to snip be generally an extension of some previous guidance we released. If you've not listened to that one, you may want to go back and listen to it. Although I would suggest that this one stands on its own. So if you're a new listener to the community, you can pick up here and you'll probably be fine.
This one's more in depth too. We've got a lot to cover today. And in this whole cast, we've got performance matters, but it's not everything. Look for strong relationship skills. Look for solid communication skills. If you're a top performer, wants it and isn't right. That's also something we're going to touch on. The fact that you have to notify your boss and others. The idea here is that after you've done this, you're going to work on delegating projects and presentations. And finally, we recommend humility in this process. So we're going to get pretty in depth here, more in depth than, as you would imagine, a podcast called Quick and Dirty.
Yeah, was. Anytime you start with that, you know it's probably not going to be that in depth.
Mm-hmm. All right. First, foremost, up front. Performance matters, but it's not everything.
Yeah.
Obviously, we can't make and we don't recommend you make your weakest performer your successor. No boss would buy it.
Yeah, no. Nor do you want to, frankly. I mean, come on. You know it.
Yeah. Too many of us would get our feelings hurt if a weak performer could be, if they could be named to take over the role,
Why be a strong one? Like, what's the reward system here?
Fair. Okay, so it's sloppy thinking, though, to assume that because we can't name the weakest, we therefore have to name the strongest performer. Again, beware your ego. Most of us managers think we did get promoted because we were the best performer. That's what we believe about ourselves. So it's common to assume, sloppy, but common to assume it has to be the top person. And that's not the case. It cannot be the weakest, and it doesn't have to be your number one.
Exactly. There's a parallel worth remembering when we think about succession planning. And we put this out as well in some previous guidance around executive career management. If not you, who. In that guidance, we described a common technique among boards who choose their next CEO. The question that all CEOs, or all potential CEOs, all CEOs directs, I suppose, are asked is, if not you, then who? And it's a great question to ask.
It's tricky,
and it's so freaking smart because you have to assume at the top of organizations, virtually everyone who reports directly to the CEO wants to be the CEO.
Even probably one level deeper.
Oh, yeah.
At the top, people want to be CEO.
Of course they do. To even get that far, to even put in the effort it takes to get that far, you need the level of drive that is required for a desire to be CEO. You just do. And what that means is all the CEOs directs want to be the next CEO. So if the board were to just ask all of those directs, whom should we choose? What are they going to say?
Me.
Exactly. And they'd have really great reasons for it, as they all do. And what is that helping anybody? You're getting the answer to the question you already knew the answer to.
Which is that everyone thinks they should have it and they think they deserve it. And they've worked really hard to get there.
Yep, absolutely.
It just gives a bunch of selfish reasons, right? The board, they're just presented with, hey, here's a bunch of reasons why it's me. And those are selfish reasons. They're very divisive because if there was a vote, and there's never a vote politically, it's not a vote. If there were votes, if there was voting, it would all be everybody voting for themselves. So there would never be a consensus.
Never, ever.
Selfish reasons, not a consensus, not helpful.
Yeah.
And this is the tricky part. The question gets to a really different issue, which is that all the people who are being asked, save one, are not going to get the job.
Yeah, exactly.
The question highlights who on this team would most people be willing to follow? So if it's not you, who would you be willing to follow? And that's a different and better question.
Yeah.
Because really, almost everyone who's asked will have to follow whoever is chosen. Excepting the person who is chosen, right? They won't have to follow themselves. So asking that question, if not you, who, then highlights who are you willing to follow? And it's a good question because they're going to have to. Mm-hmm. And what would happen, right? If the board chose the most stellar recent performer, but nobody on the executive team would be willing to work for the peer who was chosen.
Exactly.
Then what?
I mean, let's face it, as callous as it is to say this, it doesn't matter how fantastic a performer your new CEO would be if all of the senior executive team quits for fantastic other jobs, obviously. But if the other people in the team are, to Kate's point, unwilling to follow, and then in turn, when that person is promoted, decide to leave the organization, despite their new CEO's what was impressive performance in past, it has meant that one, the new CEO cannot be successful because there is no team of people behind them or him or her. And it will also mean that there was a weakness inherently in the person chosen, in that that individual, the new CEO, had not developed the necessary relationships and trust to make people want to work for them. It's not just about results, it's about relationships.
Right. Performance matters, and it matters a lot.
Yeah.
And it must not be the only criteria you use to choose a successor, right? Mm-hmm. First, because, of course, we have to be willing to concede that sometimes top performers aren't the most favoritest of all the people on the team.
Mm-hmm.
Second, for more reasons than one, perhaps, depending on who that person is, consider this, though. If you promote your top performer, what happens to the aggregate performance of your team? You're going to lose a significant percentage of the team's performance. Even if your top performer wants the role, their job will be much harder if the team's performance drops by 20% because they themselves, the person who produces that 20%, is not in their previous individual contributor role. So in some cases, promoting your top performer causes your results to drop.
Yeah.
And I'll say this, no new CEO wants that. So even the person who gets the job, even if you're the star performer, you get promoted and suddenly all the team's metrics drop by 20%. Okay.
Yeah. The job has changed.
Of the CEO.
Yeah, of the CEO. Exactly. The CEO's job.
Because the output of the team who reports to the CEO has dropped significantly. And that is a huge issue. And if you're thinking about this, and maybe you're in a place where metrics are less clarified, and that's valid, it's often easy to envision this in a sales team environment, because in sales team environments, results are very clearly defined. There's a number. If you don't hit your number, that's an issue, right? So think about being a sales manager. If you promote your top performer, the new top performer, is now the person who used to be number two in performance rankings.
Yeah.
How many dollars of performance did you lose when you took your top performer out of the aggregate performance pool?
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Perhaps millions of dollars.
Yeah, perhaps a detrimental amount.
And okay, I don't want to hit this too hard because I don't want people to think that they can't promote their top performer. I don't want to hit it too hard. And think of what that causes. Think of what you're doing. Think of what you're asking of the team, which is to cover the performance of the previous top performer somehow, or to hire a new top performer who's the best. And then there's onboarding and people are expensive. And goodness gracious, I try very hard to convince managers a lot to delegate more.
Yeah.
Talk about delegating more almost every single week. And one of the reasons that I share with people that delegation is so important is because if you're in a position where you believe that your team has enough work that you should hire,
yeah,
then you are a prime candidate for delegation. And you may not think that because that's often a position where your directs are incredibly busy.
Yeah, you feel the exact opposite.
Exactly. And what you feel is adding another person might change that busyness. You're going to take some percentage of everybody's work and move it to the new person. And I will say this, before you hire a new person, the reason to some extent that you are excited about hiring is because that person, you don't know what's wrong with them yet.
Yeah.
You don't know their weaknesses. You don't know what they're going to be poorly able to do. And so you imagine this person who can actually take on 10% of everybody's workload. In fact, that person is fictional.
Yes.
And so you say to yourself, okay, well, they won't be great. Kate, I get it. They won't be great. Sure, I'll admit that. Fine. Still, we need somebody to take the bottom 10% of everybody's workload. Better to ask yourself, of the team you have, is the bottom 10% of everyone's workload valid? Is it useful? Could it be automated? Could it be eliminated? Because frankly, that new person, you don't know how good they're going to be. And if you're in this position and you promote your top performer, then suddenly everybody's lost the ability to create some percentage of the results. And now you have to hire a new person to do it and you don't know where their horns are. It's the halo and horn thing. Mm-hmm. You over-perceive. That's not a good word.
Well,
that's not helpful. We over-emphasize in our minds the horns of the people who work for us and overemphasize in our minds the halos of those people who do not work for us. The odds that you will hire another person to make up your top performers' metrics are quite low, in fact.
Well, even if you could, you're not going to do it in the short term.
Yeah, you're a year
You're a away. Year away from that. So there's going to for sure be a drop in quality. For sure, guaranteed. So whatever the case, you don't need to choose your top performer as your successor. In many cases, your second or third or even fourth performer potentially might very well be the one best suited to lead and manage other people. Mm-hmm. Consider performance as your first criteria. Again, Kate mentioned, it is the most important criteria, but it's not the end-all be-all. It's not everything. And this guidance changes a little bit, slightly. If you're a director, a manager of managers, the performance of your directs, who are themselves managers, is a much better predictor of success at your level as compared to the promotion of an individual contributor, for example, to their very first managerial role, right? Again, the roles are more similar. Performance as a manager is a better predictor of one's success as a director generally than trying to use one's individual contributor performance as an indicator about whether or not they will be a good first-time manager in performance.
We're right back in the mix with results, y'all. When you are an individual contributor, the majority of people who are individual contributors get promoted to be managers because they're good at producing results. And everyone in the organization is responsible for results. If you're good at it, there's an assumption that you can then also take on the added responsibility of managerial prowess, which is retention. So it's not necessarily true that just because you're super great at creating results, that you will also be good at creating retention. And we have spent the majority of our careers at this point, actually. I think you and I have both been in these roles longer than we've been in our previous roles. Is that true for you too?
Yeah. I've been with Managed Tools longer than any other single company for sure.
Yeah. So we have spent the majority of our careers teaching people how to behave successfully as managers. And in terms of predicting success, the reason people who are, for example, like me, engineers who got promoted to be managers, the reason that happens to you is because you're good at producing results.
Yeah. There's no other indicator to measure, right? That's all you got.
Absolutely.
That's all the individual contributors share. And it's the only gauge, it's the only measure of comparison amongst individual contributors is results, because that's the only responsibility. So
yes,
of course you use that as your indicator. That's what they all share.
Right. It's not to say that we can't look at other things about our individual contributors.
Sure.
It's that that's the one that levels the playing field. This is the one that says, hey, we can measure this. This is the one we've been measuring for these people. And now we want to compare it to each other. Absolutely. And so it's different going from individual contributor to manager. It's different going from manager to director. Those are two different level ups. Mm-hmm. And performance shifts in terms of importance as you move up the organization. Relationships are, as you ascend, more important.
Oh, yes.
I would suggest.
They're really, really important for all the people all the time. So I don't want to put too fine a point on it, but you're absolutely right.
For changing roles, they become more important as you move up.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Miami, we're headed your way March 26th and 27th. Come to our EMC and ECC and learn how to create results and retention and how to be better understood by your colleagues. We'll answer your questions about professional life as well as any questions you might have about the podcast. Miami, March 26th and 27th. Sign up at manager-tools.com/training. So whoever you choose to be your successor must have excellent relationship skills.
Exactly. Managing and leading others generally requires more than just being good at the roles that you're leading. Many managers don't even realize that they've likely undergone a change in their own relationship skills as they moved from individual contributor to manager. It's like when you're in it, you don't realize the amount of change, but you don't see somebody for 3 years and they're like, oh, wow, you've changed. And you're like, really? Because I feel like I look the exact same though, right? They're like, no, you really have. It's that moment. You're a fish in the water. You don't see. You have no idea how much you're changing. And your relationship skills, when you take that move, individual to contributor or individual contributor to manager, are increasing naturally in a way that you don't even realize is influencing your life. And this is particularly true when they're chosen as number two or successor based solely on individual performance.
If we go back to our CEO succession question that we discussed earlier, I think this is a helpful analogy. Again, the senior exec who is most trusted and most respected will likely be the one who gets the most votes in the if not you, who category.
Exactly.
That's because they built good relationships and they're trusted by their peers. It's a good proxy for them being able to lead their former peers. Further, their peers will likely stick around, even if only for a year or two, which would make the transition with the new CEO as smooth as can be expected, because it is going to be tough. That transition, that final jump is tough. It's hard.
It's a step change increase. It's a different thing. Yeah, it's a completely different thing. I would say also, Kate, that question, if not you, then who, doesn't fully ignore results. You're not asking about results, but I would venture to guess that the other people on the team wouldn't choose an individual who was a lower performer, knowing that they're doing a lot of work to make up for that person's performance. So it's kind of got this, I want to say this beautiful little combination of both.
Mm-hmm.
Both will they choose a person they would work for and they would enjoy working for, but also they won't choose a person whose results are ones which they themselves see and receive, I'm going to say negative consequences due to lack of delivery. It's got a little measure of both.
I would suggest too, at that level, asking that group of people that question, they know that results are important. They have put in enough time and effort for their understanding of what's being asked of that role to color their question. They're not simply asking based on who they like the most. And that's not what we're positing here. We're suggesting that people who are at the level at which they're being asked this question know what goes into that role and have some context. And frankly, they probably care enough about the company, the role, the job, the group to answer it with positive intent. It's not being answered in a way that is based on, well, you know, I'm going to politicize this. Although I'm sure some people do. However, overall, we're going to assume positive intent yet again. And this is often where top performers stumble.
Like the results versus relationships thing.
Yeah, absolutely. DISC is a great proxy for this. A high D, a person who puts performance above all else, often does so at the expense of relationships. They may not care enough about relationships and they may not work to build them. They may not support them. They may have left their feelings at home under the bed. When they then have managerial responsibilities, it takes them longer and maybe too long sometimes for some people to discover that relationships are a core part of managing and leading. That's a very hard transition to make from I don't care at all to I'm willing to engage in behaviors that will support relationship building and stuff like that. It can be really hard, especially once you get to a certain level. If somebody's at a director level and they've gotten there by being high D, the longer someone's been behaving a certain way, the harder I think it is for that change to occur and for them to be convinced that it's a valid change. Because frankly, I got all this way by being this way. And in general, that's a problem some executives struggle with. In fact, I would suggest all executives have some form of the what got you here won't get you there
syndrome. Yeah, I was just going to say that. That is exactly what was in my mind. Yeah, because you see, you've got indicators. I mean, the environment is giving you indicators to suggest that what you're doing is working. And if it were giving you indicators to suggest it wasn't, you probably would have learned the lesson and changed it by now. But because the rewards are coming from being the way you are, why change that? You've got no reason to until, in this case, you've got reason to. And it may be too late, I suppose, is the crux of our point here. It may be too late if you choose that results person. By the time they figure it out, it may take too long to make the adjustment. So if you're in this position and you're trying to figure it out or you're wondering how to assess relationship building skills, going to detail about that is, unfortunately for you right now, beyond the scope of this guidance. But we will give you a simple proxy for measuring it. Just pay attention to your directs as they interact with each other. I mean, you go to meetings with them all the time. I mean, you see them. It may just be on Zoom virtually, but you're seeing them. You're seeing them interact with the world in a staff meeting. Pay attention to who your directs listen to. When one of your candidates, right, these potential successor candidates speaks up, do other people listen? Or do they check out or do they roll their eyes or maybe they stop taking notes when that person speaks? What comments do they agree with? Whose comments do they fully on ignore? Just don't even pay attention. When somebody interrupts, do they get frustrated or do they tolerate it because they respect whomever interrupted them? Watching for these indicators that the other people in the room will give you is a good indicator of natural relationships of your potential successor with other people on the team. Because we have to assume in basically 100% of the cases, the way an individual, in this case, your top performer, let's say, interacts with you is different than the way they interact with others. It just is. Because you're the manager. It's a different situation. You're not a peer.
Yeah.
And you can't assume the way this individual behaves with you is the way they behave with others. Frankly, I would suggest you can assume it's not. They actually behave differently with others than they behave with you. So you need other indicators, and watching them in meetings, things like that, can be just ways of you measuring it in an informal way.
There's a point there too about the fact that your directs do interact differently with their peers than they do with you. That is really well highlighted. If you're a person listening and you've reached a director level, you have probably gone through a situation where you used to be a peer and now you're the manager, the boss, the director.
Yeah, very likely.
That's likely once you've reached a certain level that you've had that experience and you have felt it, you've seen it. And I will say this, if you're listening and you have been through that experience, you believe us. If you're listening and you haven't been through that experience, you don't believe us, that's fine. You can decide to believe us, or you can wait until it happens to you and then struggle and believe us then. Okay, so internally, yes. Also, though, externally, I would suggest it's worth looking at relationships potential successors have built outside of the team. That's part of being a manager, too. Managers are required to collaborate with others in the organization, other groups, divisions, disciplines, or even among peers who aren't part of this group. So if you're wondering whether one of your successor candidates has a strong network, you can find out in two ways. First, ask them. Just ask generally, how good are your relationships across the organization outside of our team? You can ask more specifically, whom can you call on outside of our organization for favors? Like, with whom do you have a good relationship in HR or finance or strategy? Different departments. You don't have to choose once, like all of the divisions. You could choose one or two, yeah. Right? You could choose HR, finance, operations, sales, customer service, et cetera. You know what departments you yourself have good relationships that are necessary to help you do your job.
Yeah.
Ask your directs about relationships they might have in that department, division, group as well. Do they have relationships over there?
Yeah, exactly. It's not that you wouldn't love for them to have relationships with departments that you yourself don't have relationships with. But chances are, if you've got a relationship, those would be the people they'd be liaising with most, right? Those are the important ones. Having more than that, great. But if they don't, or they struggle to have relationships with an individual in one of the groups that is mandatory, necessary for the success of the team, that would be an indicator of a potential issue, I'm going to call it. That's all for this week, folks. Thank you so much for joining us. Return again next week for the continuation of today's topic.